Right, we're continuing with the English Civil War. And last time we ended with Cromwell defeating the Scots and Charles II, who had come back to try and take the throne. And the Scots and Charles II had invaded England with this particular battle. And although Cromwell had won that battle, Charles had managed to evade capture and was smuggled out of England by Jesuit priests and returned to France. This was in 1651. Cromwell returned to London a hero. However, as Robertson said, for all his might as a leader of an army and his moral force in the Commons, Cromwell was frustrated by the rumps, that's the Parliament, the reduced Parliament, the rumps' lack of progress. It failed to arrange fresh elections to do away with titles and monopolies, although its failure to reform the law infuriated him the most. So he's very frustrated with this Parliament, and this goes on for now like 2 years thereabouts, year and a half, where they're just not moving on stuff, they're not getting on with the job. The Hale Commission had drawn up a report with proposals for changing the laws, including that imprisonment for debt should be abolished. They wanted law to be fused with equity. They wanted new county courts established at the main provincial center so that people weren't having to travel so far. Really, Cromwell's heart was that to make the law fair to the people and easy to, you know, so justice could be seen to be done. But there were 33 lawyer MPs who sat regularly on the Commons, comprising half the House, and they managed to obstruct every attempt to implement the changes. Okay, now you're going to see such deja vu here. And what was going on there and how we see our own political situation. The most influential of these men were Whitlock and Widdrington. I don't know if you can remember going back when Charles I had been arrested and they were going to put him on trial. These two men, Whitlock and Widdrington, they fled from London because they were afraid Cromwell was going to ask them to head up the prosecution, and they just disappeared. And that's when Cook stood up to the post, John Cook, and led the prosecution. And when the king was executed, these two guys came back. So their fleeing was not on moral grounds. It was just purely fear. Anyway, they are now hindering everything in this parliament, stopping stuff from being passed and preventing progress. And they were firmly opposed to any reform that could threaten professional privileges. And so they were fighting to protect themselves and their friends. Cromwell's army had petitioned the rump to hold fresh elections, implement the Hale Commission's proposal, and get on with abolishing corrupt officials and ungodly ministers, but to no avail. Okay, so now we get a potential controversial issue with Cromwell's behavior. On the 1st of April, 1653, Cromwell led his troops into the House of Commons, and he picked up he called it a bauble. It's kind of the symbol of authority that they would have, this kind of mace or whatever it was. But anyway, he said, "Take away this bauble," he ordered, which symbolized parliamentary sovereignty. "You are no parliament," he shouted, listing their failures to provide speedy justice and their protection of the legal profession amongst their chief sins. So he railed on them and basically shut down parliament. So here, I'm not saying we have to arrive at a conclusion, but you know, what do you do when corrupt people use the law to prevent justice? Parliament was saying, "We are the only ones who can make and change laws. We refuse to change these laws that are unjust. Now what? Now we've got a stalemate." So Cromwell acted. You can weigh up what you think of that. And because Parliament's basically saying, we want to protect the corruption by law. Well, this is just an example of deep government, where you're in a position to hold on, to manipulate, to control. Now, it's funny, Daubigny in his book, The Protector, obviously he's very pro-Reformation and Cromwell, but the historian criticizes Cromwell for doing this, but then said, what he did was truly good for the Commonwealth. Okay. Cromwell set up an assembly of notables. So when he disbanded that, it wasn't like he's grasping for power. He set up an assembly of notables, men who were of approved fidelity and honesty, known for their fear of God, their intelligence, and renunciation of worldly possessions. Okay, so these were, they had demonstrated character. When Cromwell had assembled such a team, he summoned them to undertake the renovation of the state. He had selected 139 representatives for England, 6 for Wales, and 5 for Scotland. Now, this council opened on the 4th of July, 1653. And Robertson says, the rump was replaced by a caretaker parliament, which would encourage and countenance all God's people, reform the law, and administer justice impartially, hoping thereby the people might forget monarchy. Okay, so we're trying to move them away from this crutch that they've had their whole life. This parliament lasted only 6 months before dissolving itself. They received tremendous resistance as well, and so they dissolved, and they invited Cromwell to come and act as Lord Protector of England under a document called an Instrument of Government. Okay, so they had this document, and Robertson says, this remarkable document, drafted by John Lambert, was Britain's first and only written constitution. It was also the first law to embody the bedrock principles of a modern democracy, under which the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Wales would be governed by a head of state and executive council, which would not tax or make war or legislate without parliamentary consent. It sought to preclude any form of dictatorship. Legislative authority resided in the people assembled in Parliament, elected every 3 years by all male citizens in England and Wales who were worth £200, unless they were English royalists who would be banned from voting for 9 years, or Roman Catholics or Irish rebels who would be permanently disenfranchised. Legislation had to be presented for the Lord Protectorate's consent, but he had no negative voice if he did not consent within a month or satisfy Parliament that they should change the law. So if he couldn't convince them, or if he just ignored it, it automatically became law. So he had this chance. He had to sign it. So it's kind of similar to our system where we bring the law and the president should sign it. If he doesn't, it goes back, and well, we're slightly different. But here he had a chance to try and convince them not to pass it. But if he failed on that, then it became law. Parliament had to approve the appointment of senior judges who were to have security of tenure for life. So they were independent of the protector and his council. They weren't subject to him. Any law which interfered with religious doctrine or worship was unconstitutional, provided the liberty to be extended to popery and prelacy that wasn't extended in that direction. So they were still controlling Roman Catholicism. The liberty would be extended to those who professed Christ, and it wouldn't be extended to those who practiced certain licentiousnesses. So there was certain moral conditions that we'll give you freedom to worship, but within these parameters. Really, it was Protestant mainline excluding Catholicism. So we get a franchise here. I mean, this, you know, it's an idea we need to continue wrestling with in our own minds. Is a franchise something that's democratic? Or is an open, anybody can vote no matter who you are? Is that the destruction of democracy in the name of democracy? Basically, the idea here was that the English could go to heaven on their own way without the help of Catholic priests, Anglican bishops, or ranters who thought that since salvation was preordained, they could live however they wanted. The Lord Protector was empowered to award honours, but could not grant pardons for murder or for treason. He was in effect president for life, but crucially, his office would be elective and not hereditary. And on his death, the council must meet immediately and not disband until they elect his successor. So there was this continuity factor. So this was what was drawn up, and Cromwell received the position of Lord Protectorate, and elections were held, and a new parliament was elected and began sitting on September the 4th, 1654. But things continued to be incredibly turbulent in the whole of England. With Cromwell was desperate to prevent the country returning to bloodshed and establish religious freedom for Protestants to worship according to their consciences. Those were his main things. He was trying to keep stop this thing from spiraling into bloodshed or back to the royals coming back. And it was an incredible, difficult task that only because of his great strength and because he was so respected, particularly by the military and also by civilians, but because of that, that he was able to stop it from spiraling out of control. You see, because now that the elections had happened, there were people elected to Parliament who were opposed to the reforms that Cromwell wished to accomplish. And it's just your people, there's royalists in there, there's all these different kinds of people, Presbyterians. There was a tract written at the time as well about let's assassinate Cromwell. I know at least one, there might have been more attempts, were actually thwarted. Cromwell thwarted at least one attempt. And he was of the conviction that the nation, and certainly the circumstances around certainly looked like it, the nation was never very far away from reverting back and losing all the gains that they had made after all that blood and suffering and of going back. So there were many different factions, different understandings about what the basis of liberty was and how to achieve it, along with trying to recover from the very destructive civil war. So it was a very harsh situation that he was functioning in. In the spring of 1657, Parliament asked Cromwell to become king, because they said the laws and the people of England understood what a king was, but they didn't understand what a protectorate was, so can you become king? And he contemplated that. He said, I'm going to seriously consider this and find God's mind and will on this. And he came back and he declined the offer. There are some letters that he wrote to his son-in-law. And my guess is he wasn't anticipating that this would ever become a published document or anything. He's writing to his son-in-law and just saying, hey, this is how I'm feeling. This is the anguish and pain and stuff I'm going through because of the incredible resistance. He says, I feel like Moses, you know, when he rebuked those two Hebrew slaves fighting and then the one turned on him. And he said, that's how I feel, because everywhere it's just this resistance and heart. He said, I wish I could just grow wings and fly away. So he was feeling the strain, but he kept to his task. So he was offered the crown in 57. He turned that down. But he had been struggling with his health since the Irish campaign back in 49, I think. And he fell sick again. I think he even suggests that he got malaria. And that was in 1658. And then his daughter Elizabeth, whom he loved greatly, she died, I think, from cancer or something. And all of this together was just compounding. And he died on the 3rd of September, 1658, at age 59. Some commented on the speed of his decline, you know, putting a question mark over it. But I've never read anything anywhere of substance that questions that it might have been foul play. But the 3rd of September 1658, if you remember, when he marched on Ireland, the first city that he had to take was the city of Drogheda. I don't know how you pronounce that truly. I'm just going with my Scottish Drogheda. And he arrived at the city and began his assault of the city on the 3rd of September 1649. When he, for the most part, hadn't completed the work in Ireland, he was called away to Scotland because Charles was coming back. So he went to Scotland and they were in this horrific situation where it was kind of like, well, the game's over for Cromwell. His army's going to be crushed. The Scottish were better numbers, better position. And on the brilliant maneuvering of Cromwell and ideas and decisiveness, on the 3rd of September, 1650, he crushed the Scottish army at the Battle of Dunbar. And just an unexpected victory. Gave all glory to God. Kept going with his campaign. The Scottish guys regrouped and Charles formed up with them. And Cromwell now extended himself far north and they made a dash. Scotland and Charles made a dash for London, which turned out to be Cromwell's hope. And he chased them and caught up with them and the Battle of Worcester was on 3rd of September, 1651. It's only an interesting fact to me. I'm not trying to read anything into it. It's just this interesting point. Before his death, Cromwell had appointed his son Richard to serve as protector. This wasn't nepotism. It wasn't either the best choice, but I think what you recognize is the dearth of people that were around. There just wasn't that leadership. And it's, you know, one of those sad things that when God doesn't raise up good leadership, in many respects, it's kind of a judgment. And so he appointed his son Richard to be the protector. And he was given permission to do that. It wasn't like he was trying to take over, some people will claim. And it didn't last very long. The struggles between the army and the civil society, along with the disaffected Presbyterians and the Royalists that were in Parliament, were too much for Richard to manage. And so after 264 days in office, he was forced to resign. So the kind of military started to flex its muscles and they started to do stuff. And now it's just like a spiral of bad decisions and calls that were made. It was on a very slippery path at this stage. So that was, he resigned on the 25th of May, 1659. And so really things became disorderly. There was bribery, lack of strong leadership, defections, poor strategy, fear. There is quite a detailed study you could do in that and look at all the things. I've decided not to go there. I think it'll be just too drawn out for us. It's not really necessary to see all their mistakes. But I do want to point out that, you know, such people were making mistakes and the leadership was not very good. And Charles II, literally in exile, he was in Brussels and he was stunned when he got the news of the disarray that was suddenly in England. He said, this is absolutely unexpected. This was kind of like, he had kind of resigned himself to living a life of debauchery in Brussels, but suddenly the door opened up. There was a general up in Scotland and he was, at heart he was a royalist. Cromwell had appointed him. He was a good general and he was now serving up in Scotland, but he was turning and in communication with the royalist guys and he was shaping his army, i.e. thinning out the Cromwell guys and filling them with more the royalist guys, and he was also preparing them for war. And Parliament declared this general, General Monk, the commander-in-chief. So Parliament is in a bit of disarray and they're just blundering, they're making wrong mistakes, and I think they're trying to find favor with the military at this stage, and so they make this guy commander-in-chief of the whole army. They get rid of probably the best guy that could have had any chance of standing up against Monk. Lambert was the guy. And Monk was very shrewd, and when he got to London, he worked things politically so that the Royalists and the Presbyterians were still hoping for this agreement with that was made, that Charles would implement the agreement they'd made with Charles II, would implement the agreement made with Charles I, and allow this Presbyterianism to flourish. And so they were hoping that that agreement would be upheld and Charles would be bound by those terms. And what you see is just this frantic time of wheeling and dealing. People are scurrying like cockroaches for cover. They're trying to work things. They're backbiting. They're betraying. It's just chaos. There were some constant guys that just stood. Cook was one of them. He stood strong and tall. And so people were trying to cover their tracks. They were trying to curry favor with the king as the rumors gained huge momentum now. And John Cook was serving as Chief Justice in Ireland at the time and was arrested by a man by the name of Coote, who was trying to make atonement for his own transgressions against the king. So Cook was now arrested in early February and held against law in a castle in Dublin. And Charles II, who was in Brussels, wrote saying he was not looking for revenge, and things developed for his return. But the way it was being forced through in London now was it was moving at a pace that he was returning unconditionally. There were no conditions. And you can imagine the Presbyterians now are pulling their hair out because suddenly they've agreed to him coming back and there's no terms, there's no agreement, they've been duped. And so he's on his way. On the 29th of May, 1660, Charles returned to London with an escort of about 20,000 horse and foot, meaning people on foot, brandishing their sword and shouting with inexpressible joy. The ways strewn with flowers and bells ringing, the streets hung with tapestry, fountains running with wine, the mayor, the aldermen, and all the companies in London in their, all the liveries, all in their best dress with chains of gold and banners, lords and nobles clad in the cloth of silver and gold and velvet, the windows and balconies all filled with well-dressed ladies, music, and myriads of people flocking. There's so many people, they say, that there were 7 hours in passing through the city as this crowd was escorting the king in. And so now they started a whole propaganda thing, and with the restoration of the Stuart line, they now presented Charles I as an iconic Christ-like figure whose blessed qualities had been inherited by his son. A very firm veil was drawn on pain of prosecution over any true accounts of Charles II in his debauched exile years. He couldn't talk about what he was doing across there in Europe. What the state needed now was a show trial in which the new king's power and influence would be on show. Those who had once dared to dim the divinely ordained light would be torn to pieces for public edification and entertainment. So that's where they're heading. And all kinds of public entertainment was back. It was the age of miracles, when fêtes and fairs and freaks and festivities were suddenly all the rage. And there was some kind of really magical ceremony that Charles entered into, and he did all strange things where it kind of gave the impression that he's magic and divine and bringing all these. You can imagine the church now going berserk. The king and those close to him regarded John Cook as the worst of the surviving regicides. A number of the top guys had died, including Cromwell, and Cook now was the number one ranked guy that they despised, because he had been the evil genius behind the prosecution. But Cook was now in the Tower of London, and he would not beg for his life. He had chosen not to flee from Dublin back in February, when he probably could have escaped and maybe got to Geneva or something. But Cook wrote to a fellow prisoner saying, "Let us not entertain damps of despondencies. My rejoicing is in a good God, a good cause, a good conscience. Men's law at Westminster will be adjudged treason in heaven. We are not traitors or murderers or fanatics, but true Christians and good commonwealthsmen, fixed and constant in the principles of sanctity, truth, justice, and mercy, which the Parliament and army declared and engaged for. We fought for the public good and would have enfranchised the people and secured the welfare of the whole groaning creation if the nation had not more delighted in servitude than in freedom." And so I'm going to spend one more lecture on Cook, just because his trial and so-called trial and consequences are worth reading. He was a man of tremendous courage and integrity, and he really is a shining light. But really, for the most part, is written up in history as this infamous scoundrel.